It's that time of the year again where your nice hosts take a few weeks off. The program will resume with new episodes in the first week of March or the end of February for Patreon supporters. But each week until then, your nice hosts will re-air one of our favorite episodes of 2025, along with a few new thoughts about each one. This week's nice replay is episode 391, The Things That Create the Geometry, What Happened with Future Club Design Surface Area, originally published May 29th, 2025. I picked this one because I detailed my experience being part of Future Club, and it was it was pretty intense for me to like describe that experience.
Yeah.
So
it's been 6 months since that episode aired, and a little bit longer since you recorded it.
Yeah.
How would you say your feelings about it have changed?
That's a good question. I think because I have some distance, I can like take some pride in a lot of the things that we did. Like, I think at that time when I was talking about Future Club stuff, I was thinking about the Kickstarter and how it failed.
Yeah.
And I don't know that I detailed it in the episode. I can't quite remember. But I know that, like, because of previous experiences, people kind of hating on Future Club work because of our relationship to Skullgirls and things. Every once in a while, I go back to the trailer we made and I see comments that people made. And it's sad, I think, to see some of the stuff because they just wanted us to fail. So I think for some distance, it helps me recognize that we did a lot of work and it was good work. Yeah. But also, I don't know, I think it's still just kind of tragic. But I'm glad that I put it out there, partly to preserve Future Club's history. Yeah. But also because I think it's important for listeners to be able to understand that, like, game dev isn't all sunshine and rainbows, right?
Yeah.
Like, sometimes there are really intense, tragic, sad things that happen to you while you're making something because you're putting your heart into it.
We really, I mean, the history of this program has been us building our careers. And it is a longer than you'd like, slow step up and forward.
Right.
But then once you get to a point, you forget that there are also steps backwards.
Yeah.
Right? When you have nothing, you're just starting. There is no backwards.
Exactly, yeah.
And you don't know, you feel like, I've got nothing, this is the worst it could be. Mm-hmm. But losing something is hard too. And it isn't until you have something.
Yeah.
And that's a very broad way of describing it. But you did a great job in this episode.
Well, thanks.
Walking us through that experience in a way that was like very mature and cogent and had lots of really good lessons for people, whether you're in that situation or not. So I really recommend people like study this one.
Listen in.
And also there are aspects of it where what you had done, which then ended up being part of that failing, were lessons that you had learned from previous work and previous failures. And so then there's also that mixed into it as well, which can only happen when you have a career that actually has some longevity where you are doing lots of stuff too.
Yeah.
And that also makes it harder, like more complex emotionally, I imagine.
Yeah, yeah. I hope that I did Future Club justice in the episode. Listeners, let us know what you think. Again, new episodes resume at the top of March. If you want to skip ahead 1 week to make the wait a bit shorter, you can do that and get all of our episodes ad-free, plus exclusive bonus content that's pretty nice too, at patreon.com/nicegamesclub.
Ship it. We're shipping it.
Yep, yep, yep.
So on a topic of me not being able to talk, I finished Chance of Sennar, a game about language.
I've heard very good things about this.
It's so good. Yeah. It's less than 10 hours and I want more people to play so I can talk about it.
Ah.
And it's really, really good. I got it for Christmas and then I played it on the flight home from visiting my family. And then I didn't touch it again.
Mm-hmm.
And then I got the bug to play it because Ian's been playing Blue Prince. And I want a puzzle to co-play as well, like to parallel play. So I finished it. It's so good.
Cool.
This seems extremely up my street.
Oh yeah.
Oh, I'm
actually
so
shocked you haven't played it yet, Mark.
I don't know that I'd heard of it.
Oh. So talking also Let's Plays, a streamer we follow, Northern Lion, he did a sponsored stream with them.
Mm.
So we got to see the first like 40 minutes of it and I was immediately like, this is so
you
good.
Got hooked.
This
like,
is my thing.
Sold
I'm,
to you.
I'm
love
gonna
it.
I'm gonna play it someday.
Cool.
So I did. It's great.
Yeah. Ooh, it's on Switch.
Yes.
Yeah. I'll buy that after the show.
And I played it on Steam Deck. It works very well on Steam Deck. And it's also, as we're going to be talking about later, it's not something, not a game that you need to take notes. If there's anything note-take-y that you need to do that is necessary, it does it for you.
Yeah.
So that's really nice, especially if you're in the context of playing it on an airplane.
Right.
Like
right.
I was. Very, very, very good. I also, it would be interesting, I don't know if you took any other languages, but I took Japanese in university. So I very much vibe with the kind of pictograph style. Like, I'm used to looking at shapes and subset shapes within a single character, in Japanese or in Chinese.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I found that to be really, really easy for me and really interesting. It was more the differences in the grammatical structure that I got.
Yeah.
I found certain pictographs harder to pick up than others. And I would love to talk with someone else who has a different language brain than I do to compare and contrast our experiences.
Okay, that's homework for me then. I got to play this game.
Please. It's so good. It takes less than 10 hours and it's really, really good.
That's good. Speaking of things that require no taping and take way more than 10 hours, your husband's playing Blueprints.
Yes.
And we talked a little bit about it because I did start playing it before our last recording session. Lydia, have you played it?
I have not. I'm going to play it after Ian finishes it, probably.
Right. So
No. Well, no, Ian's getting close.
Okay.
Ian knows what they need to do next.
Yeah.
And they just need to, they are pretty sure how to get to that point. They need to get there.
Yeah.
Oh, so that's perfect transition to like what I want to talk about with this game.
Uh-huh.
Because... And this is not like a hot take or a new take. People who have this feeling.
Yeah.
This game is too much of a roguelike.
Mm.
Whereas I've been in that situation a lot with that game where you're like, oh, I know I've solved the puzzle.
Yeah.
I know exactly what to do. Now for the next 8 hours, I'm going to roll the dice until I get the thing I need.
Sure.
And then, like, you know, which is, of course, you also need to like play the roguelike like it's intended by manipulating the RNG and like making the choices and adapting to it. But man, what a slog. Like, not fun at all. I feel like after I beat the game, and there's tons of post-game content.
Yeah.
It's such a rich, deep world. It kept me engaged, even though I essentially hated every minute of it.
Okay.
And eventually, I had to just bounce.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I put in maybe 30 hours total.
Yeah.
And I fully the last 5 or 6 of them were making no progress at all. After I had solved all the things in front of me.
Sure.
And just thinking, like, if this is the pace, and it might not be, right? It might be, I might have been just 30 minutes away from a breakthrough. But then after that, I don't know. Like, I didn't feel it respected my time in a way. Yeah. Like, I'm okay with a long game. I'm okay with a slow game, right? But at a certain point, I'm just like, I'm an adult. Like, I don't have a college student's endurance for this. Like, I love the story. I love how rich and deep it is. But speaking of the note-taking, like, it didn't feel like there was... It was so deep and complicated, the puzzles, which is not a problem. Nothing wrong with that, right? What's great about it is how meta it is. You find one clue in one place and one clue in another. And its roguelike elements are really responsible for that. So to its great credit.
Right.
But it just, the puzzles were not deep enough for me to spend that much time on it.
Oh, interesting. Because the thing is, Ian's been filling their D&D notebook with notes and multiple different ways to affect the RNG and also just to get... to make sure that future runs are able to happen. So like now, through a combination of events, they can start a day with 90 steps.
Yeah.
And I think also I would love to actually get in on just debate with you. Because, I mean, that to be fair, we love puzzle games. We love like narrative games. We also really love roguelikes.
Yeah, I think that's what it is. It's like part of it's just to taste. Because I was getting really good at the roguelike elements. Like I was getting all those steps. I had a really high inheritance. I knew where all the rooms were best likely to spawn. Like I knew all those different things. And yet I would still get to a point where I roll the dice and my whole thing would be ruined. And I'm like, I know that's normal. That's expected. That's part of the thing. But like, I have like a thing I have to get to in an hour, and like I thought I would. It's just I just didn't feel like I understand that chance of failure is part of the feeling of progress that comes eventually.
It's just
not for me, and it was so frustrating because I loved a lot about it otherwise.
I want to say I think that there is a very distinct and valid difference in I think how we approach roguelikes, because as a lover of roguelikes, if I'm going out with a mission to do something and I keep failing, it is so frustrating. When I was trying to unlock The Lost in The Binding of Isaac, so I have to constantly keep, you know, you're trying to just constantly press R, restart, refresh, to get the right conditions. And then if you get it wrong, then you have to go back to the beginning. That makes roguelikes frustrating.
But that's not the right attitude, right? The right attitude is to have a mission and let it be changed and adapt to the circumstances that come.
Yeah, there's a serendipity of it. And I've actually been kind of witnessing the serendipity of it, where it's like, Ian, you know, started a day and ended up finding some really interesting lore in that particular day in Blueprints, but not necessarily advancing any puzzles or like advanced in some of the puzzles, but not in the way that they thought.
Yeah, there's a portion of the game where you were having all these failed runs, but then you come away with a little new information. And then eventually that well runs dry and you just have to wait to stumble on something. So that's the part that I was getting frustrated by is I'd be like, I really enjoyed finding something I'm going for this, but instead I found this other thing. It's fun to change tack because you realize that, oh, you know what, actually, I think I have a better shot at this other thing. I'm going to go for that instead. That's fun. But then even that hardly ever ends well. And then at a certain point, I would get something. In fact, when I beat the game, like the normal, you know, roll credits, it was because I got really lucky on a particular run that I wasn't going for that. And then credits rolled, and I'm like, it was so unsatisfying because I wasn't going for that.
Yeah,
I just had to, the game guided me to it because of the luck I drew. And I was good enough at the systems to know when to take advantage of good luck. But like, I didn't feel like I was the one playing the game at that point.
Oh.
You know? But I think it definitely is to taste. I can't.
Yeah.
The game is so well considered. All those choices are intentional. I just think a lot of them are bad. But like, it's that way on purpose. And if you love it, like, I'm so jealous.
Yeah. Dear listener, know thyself. Know if you are a Mark or if you are an Ian.
Yeah.
And make decisions accordingly.
But, man, a 12-hour version of that game would be a masterpiece. But nope. Forever and ever and ever. And I'm never going to know all the interesting extra lore that I was working on when I beat the game and then decided to quit.
Like, well, this is when then you just talk about it with other people who've played.
I guess so.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah. I have no comments. I haven't played the game.
Yeah, I think you should, Steven.
I know.
I think it's
okay,
kind
but
of game
do you like roguelikes, or am I going to be 1v2 here?
I like roguelikes, but I heard there's a whole post-game thing, and then I was like, I don't want to deal with that. So that's why I stopped. Because I think I like roguelikes up until the point where like I beat it, and then I'm like I beat it, and then there's like more stuff. So I'm not opposed to that, but it just depends on how
you are just interested in beating it. It's not I think it could have been half the length, even with randomized elements.
Sure.
But I think you could beat it and be happy to be done.
Okay.
And I think an average run takes maybe 25 hours or something.
Oh, okay. Well, that's a better sell on it. I think it seemed like a lot of people didn't get into the game until they beat the game.
Well, because I think once you reach the beating of the game, all of the things that are going to come after it start to become apparent to you.
Oh, okay.
And so when you beat the game, you're encouraged to keep going because it doesn't really feel like an end at all.
I'm going to...
But I think you might roll credits. You might be like, okay, like...
Okay, after we record, I want to ask what you mean by that.
I know, you have to be kind of cagey because it's a spoilery kind of...
Well, because I think... I know Ian has discovered some things and is pursuing kind of side... information gathering about stuff, and I'm wondering if that's what you're alluding to, because if so, then Ian's pursuing both of those in tandem.
Oh, you have
I'm curious about that,
Right, that's the thing about a game like this, and that is why there's so much endgame content, because otherwise there would not be enough for you to do to get to the end of the game. If all there was just the main story, then the randomization would be so brutal.
Right.
And so it has to have more stuff, and so that's kind of why I think there's credit to the game. It is all tied together in a way.
Yeah.
But I think it's inevitably reaching a shape that I don't like as much.
Sure.
But that, again, it is all very deliberate.
Yeah.
But I think it's definitely a game that game designers should play, you know?
Okay.
Because I think they'll be the ones who understand best, even if they don't like it.
Yeah.
And if they don't like it entirely, like, there's a lot I do like about it.
Yeah.
I think a lot of the puzzles are really clever and interesting, especially how meta they are and how interconnected all the systems are. It's so clever, a marriage of like story and design. And then I hated every other minute of it.
I will say, Ian found a soil survey in the game, and it just made their little soil dirt geology loving heart.
They felt a little bit seen.
They were so happy.
Yeah.
They were so happy.
Amazing. It's pretty good. Okay, other meta news before we get into it today. Switch 2 pre-orders.
Mm-hmm.
So when I was editing an episode recently, we were talking about the Switch being announced and the pre-orders being delayed.
Yeah.
And that episode came out, at least on Patreon, the day that the pre-orders really did come out. So, which that's telling us about our schedule. It'll be weeks ago by the time listeners hear this. But that night after I edited, I was like opening tabs to do that.
Right.
Did either of you?
No, I got a system.
What?
Oh, you go to a store.
I go to a place to get it.
Yeah.
It makes it sound like
you think they still do that now?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm convinced.
Okay.
I ain't got to worry. I got the Wii on launch. I got the Switch on launch. I didn't pre-order it. I barely waited in line.
Yeah
I'm good.
Okay.
I'm convinced of that.
We've made the decision not to get pre-order a Switch too.
Yeah.
Ian did pre-order, or no, Ian didn't pre-order, but Ian did try get a Switch when it came out and only found it in this like one box store in Duluth that is not where young people go.
Yeah.
It's like only where old people go to shop, which meant that they actually had Switches in stock.
Right.
That store no longer exists. Rest in peace.
Dang.
But yeah, we've decided we're not going to get the pre-order of it.
You're just going to wait till it's not a drama.
Yeah.
That makes sense.
Fair enough. So my story is, because I'm really good at this kind of thing, like, because I have kind of like what I'm doing now, I'm happy to do forever.
Yeah.
So like, I'm happy to be focused on like having all the tabs open and like, you know.
Yeah.
It's awful. But like, I also have a very strong opinion that I think like these kinds of pre-order are shenanigans. And like, listeners surely know about this, like just all the websites crash and they don't handle things well. Mm-hmm. Orders get canceled. Bots are like so prevalent. Like in my mind, it was like, just sign up a week in advance and do a lottery. Like, I don't care if that means I'm less likely to get it because I'm experienced at this kind of like, you know, F5 forever. But like, it is just, it shuts people
like a lot of stress.
Well, it shuts people out of gamer culture because it means that people who are on the ball or like really obsessed with this kind of thing are the only ones who really have the capacity to deal with the headache.
Mm. Yeah.
Whereas I think I think that's part of gamer culture. And I think that because a lot of people feel like they can't do that because it's a hassle, or like, or they'll try and they get such a bad experience.
Yeah.
They're like, that's just for like gamer people.
Yeah. That, why bother participating?
That further makes gamer a separate culture from everybody else, which is, we've talked a lot on the show. Like, there's no like movie going culture that's separate from mainstream culture.
Right.
But games, despite all its success as an industry, is still this little subculture, which it makes no sense at all.
And I think
things like this are part of why. Anyway, but until then, I usually have a good shot at these things. I did get one, but I wasn't sure that it looked like it might not stick, basically. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to give all the details. So I just kept all the other tabs open as they were going. And the different stores like started late, or every one of them had their own separate dramas that I'm following on Blue Sky.
Yeah.
And so I'm like, okay, well, I guess I'm done. It's an hour past the thing starting. Mm-hmm. Surely they're all sold out. The websites don't all say that they're done yet. But then on Blue Sky, someone said like, oh, they're back at Target. And so I'm like, okay, let me go over there, because the thing was like a second ago that someone posted that. I go, and it turns out, yes, they were. And so, oh, because the reason I was still at it was because I didn't get the Mario Kart bundle. I clicked the wrong button, like when it was in one queue.
Oh,
I couldn't leave it.
Yeah.
And so I didn't. So, you know, it's the $30 difference.
That's significant.
So, anyway, so I'm like, well, then I can return that, or I can sell it to someone in the community or something. Mm-hmm. But so when that came up again on Target, I did that. Looked like it worked, but it didn't. Mm. And I'm like, well, no big deal. But then I'm like, well, let me just try it again. And it did work. And then at the exact same moment, Best Buy, that I've been waiting in like a digital queue, and that showed up. And I had two.
Oh.
And it was literally the exact same time I was pressing over and over on the Target webpage that the Best Buy one showed it up. And just my lizard brain took over.
Oh.
And so I pre-ordered a third one. Like, I absolutely did not intend to.
Sir, so, who are you?
So yeah. I'm sitting on three pre-orders.
Oh, my.
And so I'm going to ask you again, do either of you pre-order Switch 2?
Maybe you did for me.
I mean, do you want it?
Hold on. I'm a text
one of
my
you's
husband.
Not getting Mario Kart.
I don't care about Mario Kart, really.
Okay.
Yo.
I'm playing Santa Claus here a little
Mark
bit.
Mark pre-ordered... Yeah. Three Switch 2s.
Don't embarrass me.
I'm embarrassing you. Do we want one?
I would say I don't know how people in our audience feel, but like, I'm extremely embarrassed by this.
Oh.
I'm sorry.
I told the story, but like, I think it's like, it's so dumb. It's so dumb. Mm-mm. And when you're like that moment where you're like at, you know, with all the tabs open and you're like refreshing, like I just feel like a child. It's so silly. But yeah, I got three of them.
Yeah.
Okay.
But like, you know, they're not going to charge me until they ship. So.
Right. Oh, good. Okay.
So
okay.
I would like to find somebody to sell it to before then.
Yeah.
And just happen to have two lovely folks here in this three-person clubhouse.
Being
and I happen
put
to
on
have
the
three.
Spot.
So, you know.
We'll see. The husbando is cogitating. Okay. So far, holy shit. Sure. If yeah. he's offering, I would not mind the upgrade.
Oh, that's yeah. funny. But I will say, I think the report generally, if you were like invested, like if you were doing the refreshing,
yeah.
I think most people were able to secure one.
Yeah.
Unlike in the Wii days or even the Switch days, mm-hmm. where fully most people couldn't do it. I think it was just if you stuck with it after 1205 and kept trying. Most people probably could have.
Yeah.
But that still ruled out a bunch of people who gave up at 1210 and didn't realize if they just kept at it.
Yeah.
Which is the part of it I hate so much.
Right.
Yeah.
But it doesn't seem like, I suspect on June 5th when it goes on sale, maybe 2 or 3 weeks later, you might be able to walk into a store and buy one.
Okay.
I don't know that it'll be a big deal. But okay. in the case that it might, I've got one for each of you.
All right.
Thank you. It's
good to know.
And also, we have a community of friends here and mm-hmm. peoples. Yeah. And yeah. I mean, I guess that's the thing we talked about last time. Tariffs and stuff, is that also going to influence things?
So this is something that, because I follow the news so closely, just hearing all the gamer press talk about it, I'm just like, just read the news. You'll know what's going on. So they updated accessory prices.
Yeah.
But they announced very early they weren't going to change the base price of the product.
Okay, cool.
Yeah.
Part of that is that they'd been, this was reported like months and months ago, Nintendo had been stockpiling units in a warehouse in the United States for exactly this reason.
Yeah.
But the tariff news was so wild, even more than, but they had prepared for even a little bit of an adjustment.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's helping them here. But, and also there's definitely a PR hit to say like we're increasing we don't have to increase it by a lot. Like people have their opinions about this. We don't need to get too deep into it, but it is one of the most insane monkey wrenches in the global economy. In the history of mankind.
Like, yep. Yeah.
It is so dumb.
Yep.
And everyone's dealing with it in different ways. But like one of those things is like, well, if you had just that day announced a product's price and people are already unhappy that it's too expensive, like, are you going to just eat the tariffs because you don't want to further alienate your audience? Because maybe. Yeah. But who knows? How well can you communicate to an audience of lay people that the price increase is not price gouging?
Yeah.
Like, it's really hard to do.
Right? Yeah. I think, in part because the news changes so quickly. It honestly feels like it's changing like Minnesota weather.
Yeah.
Where it's like 1 minute later, you have wrong information now.
Most of the stuff that was announced that day is not happening.
Yeah.
Like, already.
It's, yeah.
But whatever. But no, Nintendo, they canceled the original pre-order date, but nothing else changed. They did increase the prices of a lot of the accessories by a considerable amount.
Uh-huh.
And I think that was their move because I don't think they stockpiled enough of that stuff in the U.S., Also, I think that's something that people are less upset about. No one's really that, they don't really need a second set of Joy-Cons.
Well, because it's like an as needed thing.
Yeah.
And that's also something where I imagine once they get the Switch, they will find out that they want it much, much, much later. And so,
yes.
Yeah. Because I don't think we got our second pair of Joy-Cons until like a year after we got the Switch.
And I don't know that I'm ever going to get a second pair of Joy-Cons because this one doesn't have fun colors. And
true.
The red and blue are actually also they're paired with the system.
Yeah.
The system itself has a red and blue stripe on the inside.
Oh.
So I'm thinking they're not going to do colors this generation.
Oh, that's sad.
That's sad.
I'm mad because like I actually just recently got the Princess Peach Peach Joy-Con. They're my favorite.
Ooh.
You pair them with the gray ones, the classic gray ones too.
Cute.
But I'm like a controller fiend. I buy way too many controllers.
I want to get the little joystick caps that look like different things, like paw prints and like.
Dale has some of those. She has a peach and pear.
Oh, cute.
It's pretty cute.
Yeah.
Definitely. That's one of the reasons why you might want to buy one now. Because who's to say what the supply will be?
True.
Independent of the fact that it's proving very popular, the pre-orders as such. The Nintendo did a press release saying that they had, for their Japan pre-order, the one they were selling directly, they got 2.2 million signups, and they just had put out a press release that says we don't have that many. Because that's a much smaller market than the U.S.
Yeah.
And that's just for their direct sales. They said we did not make enough to cover all the people who registered interest, which is not necessarily. It seems like demand was mostly met from the pre-orders, even though it was full of nonsense.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But it looks like this isn't going to be a Wii U situation because the Wii U did sell out as well, even though it ended up being a failure in the market. But it. They also didn't make a lot to start.
Yeah. I mean, Japan does really likes handheld consoles.
Yeah.
That's why the Vita even just years after it had been there, it was still actively getting special edition releases, still getting games. All the games there were still, like, I went there and I bought so many Vita games in Japanese. Yeah. I still haven't played them, but bought them. One, it's because they weren't region locked and because they were there.
Yeah, yeah. No, I have a PlayStation Japan account for my Vita.
Nice.
I should load that up again and see. There's a bunch of games I didn't end up playing. Anyway, but no, Nintendo had been, the news had been that they had been making a lot more of these because they really were stung by the success of the Switch.
Yeah.
And I think they decided that even if this is not as successful, they want to have the supply that they can sell out slowly rather than suffer that PR damage and potential lost sales of that first year. That happened with the Wii. They missed out on a lot of the sales in the first year. And a lot of those people didn't end up buying it at all.
Yeah.
So even with that, the demand outstripping the supply, this thing is going to be a hit. Whether it sustains over its generation is a question, but that's interesting.
Yeah.
What else we got on deck today for the show?
We got a topic.
Yeah.
I brought a topic to talk about. I want to talk about Future Club.
Yes.
So, listeners may remember, it's been a little while now, a month or so ago. Future Club had started a Kickstarter up. And we talked about that on the show, and we're begging for Muggy.
Real quick, Future Club is the company, the co-op that
co-op
you work for.
That I work for, yes.
That you are a part owner in.
That I am part owner in, yes. So, if listeners were paying attention to that Kickstarter, we didn't make the goal. It was a big leap. It was a lot of money that we're asking for.
Yeah.
It was a
huge ask. We raised about a quarter of it, I think.
Yes.
Yeah.
Still a lot of money, but
yeah. I'm proud that we made a quarter of it because it was a lot of money.
Yeah.
So I feel good about what we accomplished, but we weren't able to be successful. If you were a part of that campaign, you also saw that we're talking about this as like a Hail Mary thing. If we weren't able to make it be successful with the Kickstarter, then we were effectively going to go on hibernation with the company. So we've talked about that publicly. Y'all know this, and so maybe listeners are being like, "What's Steven doing now?" I don't know why. I guess you listen to me, so you probably care about me a little bit.
Or maybe you were really interested in the game because it's really heckin' cool.
Yeah.
I'm shocked. Like, it's weird that didn't hit harder. It seems like what the market wants.
I have thoughts on how you're supposed to do a Kickstarter, and I don't think we did it right. Okay. But this is not the topic.
Fair enough.
But we should talk about that at some point. I don't have any more like direct information other than the fact that we're going into hibernation effectively. But I do want to talk about like what decisions led to us making this Kickstarter and where we were at before, I guess. Some backstory. Future Club, it's a co-op that I co-own. It is a team of mostly animators. Most of the team works as did animation for the fighting game Skullgirls. I was their only programmer. We only had a few designers, like three designers, and one narrative designer. We did not have any producers, like official full-time producers, or biz dev people.
That's hard.
Yeah, people just, filled in the roles as needed because it's a co-op and that's kind of what you did.
Yeah.
And when you were pitching, there were people who sort of grew into that space, but it was never their official role.
Exactly, right. Most of the money that we worked on most of the money that we got came from Skullgirls. Mm-hmm. I didn't work at Skullgirls, so I don't have a lot of information on how exactly that went down. Mm-hmm. But effectively, that money dwindled as years gone by.
Right.
So we had ambitions to make our own game. So, like, we were trying to sell that. We were working on a horror game about motherhood that we pitched to people in the first couple years that I started working at Future Club.
Yeah.
So, for 4 years, effectively, we were trying to get money from publishers. We pitched to a ton of different publishers initially, but the people weren't buying. initially, when we did it, we were, like, pitching to people that we knew. And not necessarily people who would be interested in the game.
Yeah.
Like because some publishers aren't interested in a horror game, not just because like they don't vibe with the horror game, but also they don't know how to sell that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's like not something within their wheelhouse.
Especially in the indie space, we're starting to get a sense of publishers that have a vibe or like, the one that immediately comes to mind is Devolver. Devolver's put out something. I'm probably going to like this.
Yeah. Yeah. They have a catalog that makes sense for their brand.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it isn't always like a aligned genre. Sometimes their brand is strong enough to be kind of a mark of something. So horror games are the types of games that are known by genre. It's really hard to have a breakout horror game that is like that would escape that audience. So you kind of need a publisher that knows how to sell a horror game.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So some of the issues that we were having is we were pitching it to people who just did not really care because it wasn't their thing.
Yeah.
And so that was our mistake. But we eventually got an agent that was helping us do this, helping us find people to pitch to and things. Mm-hmm. And now I'm like, well, was this actually helpful? Because we didn't end up getting anything. But it felt useful at the time because I definitely felt like when we were pitching it to people, I wasn't really involved with much of the pitching, to be clear. When we were pitching it to people, though, they seemed much more engaged and more interested. Yeah. But ultimately, you know, we didn't get any funding. And a lot of the times people would say that the reason we didn't get funding, they would give us unhelpful feedback on the game. That was kind of annoying. I think it kind of seems like that is the case with a lot of publishers from what I've talked with other people about. And maybe it's just like a miscommunication thing.
Yeah.
I think publishers are trying to be decent. Like, I'm not saying, well, publishers are terrible. I'm just saying that, like, I think that, like, they're trying to give you some kind of feedback, but, like, it's not necessarily something that's actionable.
Right.
That will help them in the future.
Yeah. And I think you kind of have to take that, like, any feedback.
Yeah.
Right. Like, and the feedback coming from a publisher is like, this is about, sometimes it's about market fit.
Right.
And it might not be feedback you take in, but it's good to know.
Yeah.
Because, like, they have their own expertise.
Right. Right. Right.
We talked to a friend of the show, August Brown, about that exact thing.
Yeah.
Of, like, even if it's not a right fit, you know, maybe we can give you some insight.
Yeah.
And then it's up to the developer to do what they can.
Yeah.
But it sounds like it was information that, well, might have been academically interesting. It was not actionable. Because decisions were already made.
Yeah. It was the kind of feedback that, like, maybe we could have asked for more details if we went back to them. But, like, it didn't feel like it was worth pursuing that, I guess.
Yeah.
I guess no shade on publishers, but, like, I don't know. After a while, I got really frustrated with it because it just didn't feel like people were willing to give us a chance. But to be fair to publishers, I think one of the things that Future Club is kind of that we didn't do a great job of when we were trying to pitch our game was we didn't give a good job of how the gameplay, like, actually worked. We had, like, ideas around it, but nothing, like, concrete enough for people to, like, lay their hat on. And so I think that what made it difficult was, like, people would see this awesome animation and art that we were putting in, but, like, struggled to translate that into
game?
Yeah, where's the game?
Yeah.
That was a common
that thing. Kind of, I mean, to sort of get post-mortem-y, that kind of reflects the composition of the studio.
Yeah.
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 Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, that was kind of how it worked. Mm-hmm. I think, yeah, I think also one of the major factors, though, is just that the game, a lot of times people would say it was too risky or not mainstream enough. Mm-hmm. And, like, it's a game about motherhood and it's a horror game. Like, people love those things.
Yeah.
So it seems silly to me to hear that.
Excuse you?
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah.
Well,
those publishers probably don't understand the horror game market very well.
Yeah.
And so to them, it seems risky, but they don't understand how successful it could be within that market.
Yeah.
But then that market is not huge.
Yeah. I don't know.
You know?
It just felt frustrating after a while.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But we did get one chance to make a vertical slice for this horror game. I will not say who the publisher is. I don't know if I'm allowed to. I can't remember. But I just won't say it.
Yeah. A little bit of funding for that slice.
Yeah, they gave us money to make this vertical slice. And so, like, we were able to prove out, we were given the opportunity to prove out the game loop. Mm-hmm. So as we were working on this game, we had 3 months to develop it. Halfway through it, really closer to, like, 2 months in, we realized that, like, the gameplay part wasn't working.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, publishers were right.
Yeah. Hate to admit it.
Yeah, thanks. Yeah. So we spent a ton of time, like, revamping a lot of stuff and, like, putting in a whole bunch of new things. And, you know, I'm the only programmer. So, like, a lot of that was put onto me to do it.
Yeah.
And I basically was just, like, a tech stick. People would just say, do this thing. And, you know, plug me in the computer and I'd do it. Because it was, I don't know. That was what we needed at the time.
Yeah.
But it was a lot of crunch. And listeners have known on the show that, like, I hate crunch to try to push against it. And even though this was something that would benefit not just me, but the studio, I did it, I guess, because it was the only way to get it done.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, in retrospect, I don't know. I guess I don't regret it, but I don't like that it happened.
Yeah. Well, that's why it keeps happening, is because it's like, in the end, you're like, well, it was worth it.
Yeah,
you're
needed
invested, and then
I needed to do it.
Yeah, yeah, it's really hard because
it's
true for a lot of us that go through it.
And one of these days, I want to do it. I want to talk about that, like, as a topic, like how to actually prevent crunch in a way that is actionable and useful.
Right.
Because I, it's one thing to be like, don't do it, but it's another thing to like be in the moment.
And especially because, like, the when you're in these types of small teams and you are the only person in your role, or maybe you are helpless to help the only person who's in a role and they're the bottleneck at the moment.
Yeah.
And the choice is either like crunch to get it done and hopefully get the funding so you can breathe. You have the promise of breathing or don't do it. And then there's the fear of what happens if you don't, because time is running down. Yep. It's a lose-lose situation in the moment. And the thing is it's a lose-lose situation that's framed as your well-being, your survival.
Yeah.
And so choosing something for your well-being at the cost of your well-being doesn't feel like a valid choice.
Yes. That's a great way of framing it. That's basically what happened.
You have to know what the consequences are, which is pretty common in a situation like, if we don't do this, this will happen.
Right.
But then you have to be like, it's time for us to accept that that will happen.
Yeah.
And I don't think none of us ever get there.
Because there's a possibility for it to not happen if you just crunch.
Right, right.
Yeah.
And it's within your power to prevent that outcome.
Yeah.
But it's really hard to not do that.
Right, exactly. To be clear, I don't blame anybody on Future Club for, you know, doing crunch. It wasn't just me who was doing it, too.
It's a bad space to be in that is not, like, it cannot be helped in many situations.
Absolutely, yeah. So, that's what it was. So we crunched and we tried to figure this out. We actually asked for an extension because we needed more time to add and implement some of these things. And we built it all out and we sent it to the publisher, and ultimately they opted not to go with it still. Just didn't work out. It sucks that we put in all this effort and they didn't take to it, but that's how it is.
Yeah. At least I mean, it was a project you got paid for, essentially.
Right.
And now that's not everything, because that's not what you want.
No, but it helped.
It's better than just the toil and then the sending it off and getting that response.
I guess quick question as a side note, is that in a vault where if you found some, like, happenstance found a publisher who specializes in horror games and you wanted to pursue that again, could you feasibly bring it? Could someone bring it out and go, hey, here's a thing we worked on years ago. Are you interested? Like, is it in a state where you could do that, or is it the type of thing where it's like, no, it's abandoned fully. Like, you've moved on.
So it's a complicated situation because effectively the publisher owns that.
Okay. I kind of figured that would be the case, and I wanted to just clarify that.
Yeah.
So that's a rough situation to have gotten in. But I could see why you'd
make it. Like, it all would have worked out great if it all worked out, but it didn't work out.
Yeah. You might want to look at that contract and see when that lapses.
Yeah, we're asking about that, actually, because we might want to, like, post some imagery of the game and stuff.
If they just directly bought it, I'd be surprised if it were the case.
But. Yeah. Ultimately, while all this was going on, and while we were pitching stuff, Skullgirl's money declined. I don't know a lot of the details, and they're really complicated for me as I work there. But like, basically, money started drying up. And so, like, we were kind of in a rush to get things going. And so, like, with the last year, we spent most of our time focused on the part-time hero, the deck building game that we made a Kickstarter for. Instead, because, like, we pitched the horror game so many times and people just weren't going for it, so we just tried to do this ourselves. And so we went for this deck building game, but we were debating on we I think we were starting to get frustrated with the publisher situation as well,
because
people still weren't interested even in the deck building game too. So we were looking into, like, seeing if we can get, like, grants, or potentially self-publish the game ourselves, and put it in early access so that we could get some kind of other income in aside from Skullgirl stuff. I'm very proud of the work that we did for Part-Time Hero. I think that game is amazing and I wish we could finish. I think we spent a lot of time on it in retrospect, more time than we had. It's easy to say that now. Hindsight is 2020, but I think we should have spent, I think it would have been a good idea for us to have spent some time on a smaller game. And ultimately, Part-Time Hero was supposed to be a smaller game.
Oh, is that always the way that?
Yeah, we just talked about that the other day. Yeah. It's, That's how it is. It's difficult to keep in mind. And also, like, we didn't have any full-time producers. So I think it's difficult for people to, like, be able to see the full scope of things and realize, oh, this is going to take forever.
Yeah.
Because I'm only looking at it from a coder side. I'm like, well, some of this stuff is pretty simple.
You needed a Dale to say no.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, we needed a Dale.
Like, 100%. Yeah. Just, oh, my gosh. I get nervous hearing about any project that doesn't have a producer or product manager just because of how necessary that person is.
Yeah, I've come to not just respect, but understand how important that producers are on things more and more because, like, yeah, it's just
and like a creative producer, someone who could say no, knowing that, like, the consequences will be less on the creative and more on the production.
Yes.
And knowing when to allow for a little. Like, yes, let's actually add something, mm-hmm. even though it will impact the thing because it's going to make our other cuts worth it.
Yeah.
And that's a, it's a required, it's a creative role.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. But we didn't have it. So, I think the scope of Part-Time Hero just kind of ballooned.
Yeah.
Ultimately, we got to a point where the beginning of this year, Skullgirl's money fully dried up, mm-hmm. And we needed to do something to make it so that we could succeed. And so we came up with this idea of making a Kickstarter. And we didn't know how to make a Kickstarter in this way. We have people on the team who have done successful Kickstarters in the past. That's what Indivisible was. But I think it was different. The market is different than it was when Indivisible came out, because I think Indivisible is like 10 years old or something. Maybe not 10. I always think of things in terms of 10 or 20.
Well, it's because you're old now, so.
Yep. Ha! we basically struggled to get together all this all the stuff we needed to make this Kickstarter.
Yeah.
In addition to that, we didn't spend enough time promoting it, and we definitely didn't spend any time promoting ourselves throughout this 4-year process, really.
Yeah.
We stopped doing social media and stuff because we were heads down working on stuff.
Right? Yeah.
And that's the indie dev dilemma, right? It's like, oh, if you're working on the game, you're not promoting the game. If you're promoting the game, you're not working on the game.
And, to be,
and if you don't have anything to sell, what are you promoting?
I mean, a little validating, hopefully.
Yeah.
That was what you had, that was the postmortem salute or thing that you took away from the last project was you didn't have enough of a game.
Right.
To be able to pitch it.
Yes, yes.
And now that you're pitching it to hundreds of people who are giving you their money directly, there is a big, you have that good faith.
Yeah.
And you have to establish that. And you have learned from your previous lesson, mm-hmm. but you needed support in a different way in order to actually reap the benefits of having learned that lesson.
Yeah, that's actually a really good point that I didn't consider. Is that ultimately we did learn that this horror game that we were working on, it didn't have enough of a gameplay loop for us to fit it. But we spent a lot of time on that when we were working on Part-Time Hero.
I think it showed.
Yeah.
It genuinely did.
I'm very proud of the work we did. I think it showed as well. And so that feels really good. But I think we just didn't have the time or the expertise to really get a Kickstarter together in the time that we did.
Yeah.
We were rushing, and it was, scary. So we were everything happened very fast. I think that ultimately that is why the Kickstarter wasn't successful. If we had a lot more time and more time promoting it, I think we would have done a lot better, because I think people are really like our art and animation. We weren't able to really display a lot of that in the Kickstarter. We don't have much animation other than the trailer, even in the game itself. We just didn't have enough time. So, yeah. So, basically.
Yeah.
I don't have a job right now. So, I'm looking for work. I wanted to talk about this specifically because I think that maybe people could get something out of having your own studio and having the dream to be able to make something of your own artistically and also be successful business-wise, financially. But I've been kind of coming to terms with the idea that I don't know how realistic it is to be able to do something that you really want to do and also make a living doing that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I can working on games I like, but I also want to be able to make the games that I want to make.
Right.
Yeah.
And if I were to work in AAA or even in certain other indie studios, I wouldn't necessarily get that privilege.
Yeah.
Or
rather you'd have to luck into it.
I'd have to luck into it. And I did with Future Club.
Yeah.
At least I thought I did.
Yeah. And, or be happy with the pockets of of joy that you can find within a project, because those exist.
Yeah. And so, like, I think I would enjoy working on a project, even though I wouldn't necessarily feel like full ownership of it. When I worked at Pixelix, that was kind of what I did.
And so, like, more 9-to-5 than you maybe were wanted it to be.
Yeah, but like, I was cool with that, and I was still working on games, and so I still get to, I still got to fulfill myself creatively. Mm-hmm. So I'm still looking for a job in video games.
Yeah,
but. I think I'm just starting to recognize that, like, maybe if I want to make something on my own, I have to self-fund it or figure out another way to do it that makes more sense.
Yeah, I absolutely feel that. I'm on the other side of that.
Yeah.
I you're not going to hire me to work on something unless you give me a lot of creative control or at least a voice in it.
Mm-hmm.
It's just, I've made that pretty clear. And it's closed off a lot to me.
Yeah.
But like, that's the choice I made. And I've been really lucky. The two projects I'm on are extremely small teams.
Yeah.
So there's kind of no helping it. That, like, I represent a lot of the work on it, so there's just no avoiding me having a big influence on it. And I'm lucky that that was welcomed, but I think that maybe means that, like, because I think I would really thrive in a 20 or 30 person studio.
Sure.
But, like, I wouldn't be happy.
Yeah.
And I think you are probably better emotionally capable than I am to, like, be fulfilled at a job where you're doing interesting things, but it doesn't belong to you necessarily, or you have to sign on to somebody else's vision.
Yeah.
I think you're probably better at that than I'm capable of. But it's time for you either, you know, you'll take the opportunities that come, but if you're if you're on the verge of, like, making that decision of, like, what should I focus on? You know, I'm unsure how permanent that choice has to be for you.
Oh yeah, I mean Mark was joking earlier about how old I am, but I'm not that old, right? Like, I have plenty of time to do other stuff.
Yeah,
and so, like, just because I work at a studio for even 10 years, right? Like, I doesn't mean that, like, I'm literally closed up from making my own things. So I part of it is just me trying to figure out how to be able to do that.
And you've talked in the past about how, like, you would be very things that come from you, like, we talk about the board games that we try to pitch here that come out of our night's games jams.
Yeah.
That it's, you have always described yourself as capable of being satisfied with just a couple of people playing it.
Yep. Yeah. I am. And so that makes it easier.
You don't really have ambitions for grand, like, auteur success.
Right.
Yeah.
But auteur expression is something you are interested in.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So I could see yourself, you know, just the discipline of it is hard to, like, you're working in games to work nights and weekends on other things. But like, if your demands you put on yourself are not so high, maybe that's a really good combination for you.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
But all of that is not to preclude the fact that you could get hired at a studio that leverages you and your creativity in a way that you become either a guiding creative voice or certainly a huge influence in a way that you could get everything you want.
Yeah, potentially.
Like, I see that for you.
I've never wanted to work on large games, though, which is part of the issue. Like, I don't think any of the games that I would want to make would be, like, longer than 5 hours.
Yeah.
I say that. I don't know that for sure. But at least at the time where I'm at now, that's kind of where I'm feeling. Mm-hmm. But yeah, you're right. Like, I you know, we'll see what happens, what the future will, where it will take me.
Yeah.
I did want to say, though, that, like, I love working at Future Club. And I hope that we can work again sometime. This is kind of why we say it's a hibernation. It's not the end all be all.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, it's the best place that I've ever worked at. I do also want to say, at least to put us a little bit off the hook, is that the industry right now kind of sucks.
Yeah.
And by kind of, I mean, it's terrible. I just constantly, throughout the years that I've been working at Future Club, like, we constantly are hearing that, like, the industry is really bad. There's not really any money out there. Publishers are trying to keep things close to their chest because, like, they don't want to take big risks because then they might collapse too.
Yeah.
And that would be terrible for the industry. So, like, I think ultimately, even if we did do things differently, like, I'm talking about things in hindsight, but if we did anything differently, I don't know that it would have made any difference. Maybe it would have changed how, where the money went, but, like, it would.
And how could you have ever known it?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So I think ultimately it's just hard right now in the industry.
Yeah.
So it makes it difficult.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess I just wanted to bring up, talk about Future Club. I think it's important to, like, be open about some of these things. Cause, like, I hope that, like, people will get some lessons from this.
Yeah.
Or at least understand sort of what it's like, to be indie dev.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I hope listeners appreciate the depth that you went into it with, because it is not easy. It's a bummer thing that happened.
Yeah.
And the fact that you're able to sort of in a very, I think you, I don't think you have distance from it, but I think you speak to it in a way that is very measured and wizened.
Yeah.
And I think that is hard for people to do in those moments. And the fact that you're able to, and that you can share that with our audience, is something I think people should appreciate.
Yeah. I mean, it's, I hope also, like, eventually hindsight will come full circle around and you'll see that mistakes that you all might have made were new mistakes.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, I don't know if you've ever seen Princess Diaries 2, but the whole point of, like, I've made mistakes, you should make your own mistakes.
Yeah. I've only seen the first one, but.
Oh, second is great also. worth a watch. But the fact, like, you have learned a lot and it sucks, but you haven't lost that knowledge and the ability to move forward with that, either in what didn't work or also what really, really, really works. Like, why was Future Club the best place that you worked at? You know, why did you enjoy one project versus the other? Why did one project work more than the other?
Right. I can bring that knowledge and that information into future jobs.
And because it sounds like you had, and I hope that it continues, that constant composting of experience will eventually, it's painful, but eventually it will come full circle and be helpful to you again.
Yeah.
And, you know, the contest has started for a place that can be the best place you've ever worked at.
True.
Studios out there, you know,
come get them.
Make it happen.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Listeners, thank you for telling me why I'm wrong. It was a little the way that you told me I was wrong is just by saying I was wrong. You know, that's fine. But you did it. You step up to the plate. Yeah. I appreciate that.
How did people do that?
You can go to nicegames.club/feedback. There's a little section on the bottom that says, why is Steven wrong?
Yeah.
I don't know if it specifically says that. I don't remember the wording. But you could tell me I was wrong about the wording, I guess. Don't actually do that. Also tell me other things that I have been mistaken about in the past. So it's actionable feedback so I can use it in the future to better myself.
Yep.
And we can use that feedback to better the show as well.
Yeah, we ask you what types of episodes you like.
Yeah.
We give you a big open field to type whatever you want.
Yes.
It's not a review. You don't have to say what you like about the show.
Right.
Although we don't mind hearing that.
Right.
Tell us what you like, you want more of. But just make sure, you know, we want to make sure that we don't get too stale here in the clubhouse.
Right.
Yeah.
And then, of course, special field at the very bottom. Tell Steven he's wrong about
right.
something.
Right. I do like a challenge.
You were complaining in the past on air that no one had filled that out yet. I think they're being too polite. Since then, people have corrected that.
Very
exactly.
Exciting.
Thank you, listeners.
Yes.
Keep it coming.
But I want more. So go to nicegames.club/feedback.
If getting more fiber and protein while reducing net carbs, sugar, and calories fits your health goals for the new year, get better macros in your go-to dishes with Hero Bread. From a quick 19-gram protein breakfast bagel to Taco Tuesday for your family, your favorite recipes are covered. They have sliced bread, tortillas, bagels, and more with protein and high fiber. And there's 0 to 5 grams of net carbs and 0 grams of sugar. To help hit your goals with easy swaps for your favorite bready dishes, Hero Bread is offering 10% off your order. Go to hero.co and use code HERO26 at checkout. That's 10% off with code HERO26 at HERO.co. All figures per serving of Hero Bread contains up to 18 grams of fat per serving. Not a low-calorie food. See nutrition facts at hero.co.
Okay, so kind of a big episode. I think spent a lot of time up top. Big, meaty first topic. Mine is a little bit fuzzy.
Okay.
Which is maybe the best thing to sort of end the show with. I'm calling it design surface area.
Okay.
And I think there's like a couple of metaphors. I guess maybe the one that might be most familiar with people is like attack surface. So people talk about like the number of entry points in a building or the number of vulnerable APIs in a software system.
Okay.
That's the surface area on which you could coordinate an attack, right?
Oh. So
it's like the amount of it is kind of a possibility space sort of thing, but it is very much tied to, at least in those metaphors, and that's why this is maybe an imperfect way to describe it, is like the actual points of entry, the things that create the geometry.
Okay, got you. I think I kind of follow it.
Yeah. This is a very here nor there kind of idea, but I want to talk about it because we talk about scope on the show and about not wanting to exceed it, or at least knowing what you're doing with that.
Yeah.
And I think that tends to we kind of think about that as every new idea, every new feature, every new animation that didn't have to be there.
Yeah.
Right? Is increasing the scope. Mm. And then you say, does this meet our design pillars? Is this worth the time, the effort? Is it taking away from something else? That's scope. I think that's very water in a bucket kind of measuring kind of way to think about it.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. And I think, surprise, this is an everything is everything topic. but I think thinking about it in terms of the surface area of your design,
yeah.
I think is like, if we add this thing, what else can we do?
Oh.
Or what can we no longer do?
Oh, I've had this before.
What is inside the area and what is outside the area?
Okay. Yeah.
Because sometimes you can subtract something.
Yeah.
And that increases the design space.
Yep.
Okay. Right? Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And vice versa. So I think I kind of want to talk about it in terms of like, how do I make this actionable is I guess the question I have for you two.
Well,
like, you could talk about like feature sets, like things that go together, and thinking about those connections between your systems in a way that can help you understand what is and what isn't inside the surface area.
Okay. So can I poke at what this is? This is what Ellen would do.
Yeah.
Can I poke at what this is
yes.
to figure out, what exactly you're talking about? Mm-hmm. So let's say, if we were to add a feature, this isn't necessarily like this is the possibility space that this feature applies.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So you're not necessarily looking at specifically the scope of things, because just because you add this feature doesn't mean you have to do any of the stuff in the surface area. You're specifically looking at the possibility space.
I think I like to think of it, or I'm thinking more in very much in terms of like affordances.
Okay.
So in the sense of if we have this thing, what does it then imply to the player you should be able to do?
Oh. Yes. That's really good.
I
hit this a lot with when I was working on Tablecraft, because you know, one of the things that we were trying to add in different branches of science and things you could like real things you could make from very abstract like elements to chemical to molecules to things. And one of the things we were looking at was polymers.
Yeah.
Oh boy, polymers are hard to understand. but like one of the main and we were looking at different stuff you could make with polymers, and one of the main ones is glue. Mm-hmm. We were like, we can't have glue.
Yeah.
Glue is just going to, players are going to do so much stuff with glue. It's going to be a nightmare to QA. There's going to be all these edge cases. We don't know what everyone could do with glue.
I see.
And so we had that sense of like, okay, if we add polymers, how do we then, and we know we don't want glue, how do we then clamp it down?
Okay.
Yeah. How do we minimize that affordance space so we know like, oh, I can make this, but I can't use it in these other ways that I would necessarily, or I can't make this thing and it's a thing that doesn't suggest that I can then glue everything together.
Okay.
And so you're doing more work to make the player capable of less things.
Yeah. It, as a way, what we were specifically doing is we were trying to bring, like, kind of follow a flow chart all the way to its end conclusion of if we say yes to this, what are we then potentially saying yes or no to?
Yeah.
And I've been doing this a fair bit as well. I've actually just been trying to learn how to rubber duck with myself. And I actually have started making little flow sheets of like, okay, well, if I do this, what does this then imply that I should be able to do? What does this then say mean I can't do?
Yeah.
What problems are there? What strengths are there? And then I start marking off as I go down the list, I start marking off with little knot, like the circle with an X out of or a cross in it. Mm-hmm. Like, no, don't go past here because it's a bad idea.
Okay. Yeah. That's interesting. That's definitely not the understanding that I had on it initially. My read on it was just like understanding that possibility space, but it's also what that possibility space means to the player.
Yes.
And whether they should expect, like, for instance, if you add the ability to jump in a game, people will start to think there are platforms you're supposed to jump on. Or
yes.
Yeah. Oh, exactly right. And if you don't build them, your design still includes it.
Right.
If you have a hallway full of doors and you start trying to open the doors and none of them respond or open, how are you then? Are you then primed to think when you see a key, oh, this goes to a door?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Oh. So I'm thinking about in the to be concrete with examples for myself is this FMV game that I'm working on. Mm. A big part of it is really guiding the player towards the content of the game and not the interactive components, but also making sure there's enough interactive components to interface with the content. It's a very, very clever setup we have.
Okay.
But we have to balance it and such. So we have to add, there's a couple of things we have to prevent the player from doing so that they're encouraged to do other things, because as soon as we add this interesting idea, but without following it up with the three things that are implied by it.
Mm, they're going to get distracted.
They're going to get distracted from the core thing, even if it's a satisfying experience. Because this is how it's, I think I'm separating this from like scope and production.
Okay.
Yeah. Is it's really about making sure you're thinking about how all of your design elements connect and interact, and how they service your design pillars. And also, and decoupling the amount of features, the amount of work that you put in with the amount of design exists in the game.
Yeah.
I think this actually works better if you think about it in terms of level design.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because the thing is with level design, and also just room design in general. Mm-hmm. I think a lot about this when I was working in museum exhibits, where do people naturally move? Where is their eye drawn? If you want them to go a certain direction, towards something.
Yeah, right.
You want them to be somewhat aware to perceive, acknowledge things along the way, but you don't want them to be waylaid by those things so they forget where they're going and they end up in a totally different direction.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So I think you're essentially talking a very cognitive level design here of intention mapping of the player. And when it comes to with where level design really then comes in is with the features like jumping, for instance, running, even if there's a double jump versus not, do they have a tool? The way that they do that is, this is why I love, older Zelda games, the ones I've played, is like you see a platform, you try to jump to it, you can't yet. Mm-hmm. And it's such a distance and such a height away that it is enough that you recognize, oh, this seems like something I can do. I can't do this now. Right. I'll come back.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, if we're saying in the world of jumping, because I think that's a good example. There's lots of, and we were talking about blueprints earlier in the show. There's a lot of games that are 3D sort of walking simulator types games or puzzle games or first person games. And unless it's a shooter or a platformer or an action game, generally, it's not, you don't have to worry about how far you can get or whether you can get around a corner. As soon as you hit a barrier, it's okay to, you don't need to try to get around it.
Yeah.
Like, and I think that if you were able to even just hop a little bit, like for juice reasons,
suddenly
you would start thinking about, well, at some point, the game is going to ask me to like skip on some stones.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's going to, because I know this is here for this reason. And
yeah, that's like as soon as you see the press shift to run, you're like, oh,
yeah.
No.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, I'm thinking about it in terms of like scaling down and preventing mistakes, but there's also the thing that's positive about it, which is that when you have something like that in there and you give that player that impression, so in your level design example, if you waylay someone from their main goal, then that might be intentional, right?
Well, it could be.
Maybe a big part of the mechanic, your design space is about the player needing to keep on track and the game giving them things to juggle.
Yeah, yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
That's interesting design.
Yeah.
And all you need to do is just have a little bit of an unusual path, make it a little less obvious, make them be more focused, easily distract them. Mm-hmm. And that's not necessarily an issue of like putting more things in the level.
Yeah.
Necessarily.
Yeah, that's true. It's but where it changed, you position.
But it changes the design space. And then you start thinking about like, okay, well, if that's the sort of core feeling of moving through this space, then like we get to a level that's just one long straight hallway. The player should feel suspicious.
Right.
And suddenly it's getting a little easier. Mm-hmm. Like something else is happening. That's a special area.
Yeah.
Like something about that. So all of that, I really love that example you gave, because I think it really unlocks a lot of like how this thing can work and thinking of your design in that sense and making, and again, it all boils down to everything is everything, but like if you have an intention for how you want a player to react to a thing, sometimes doing less will provide the player more.
Yeah.
And sometimes doing more will provide the player less, or just something different than you expected.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so it's, always worth it to start thinking about and validating, and you can do this with thought experiments. It all have to be playtesting.
Yeah.
But validating the notion of like what this means for everything else, and how does it, in a dimensional sense, increase or contract the design area?
Yeah. Cool. Initially, when we started this topic, I was like, "What the heck are we talking about?" But I'm on board now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
This is great. This is great.
Well, I mean, I think we got there kind of quick, which is nice, which means there's a lot left to say.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it's really about wrapping your arms around design in a way that, like, there is terms and there's language for this, but it's imperfect. And everyone's approach is different and it's hard to. So every little exercise we do, I think, I hope is useful.
Yeah.
That's our show. For show notes and links on today's topics, go to our website, nicegames.club. Nice Games Club is on Patreon. Support the show and get stuff, including ad-free episodes, delivered to you 1 week early. Sign up at patreon.com/nicegamesclub. And if you want to keep things more casual, just stop by nicegames.club/discord and say hello.
So, until we start again, remember to
play nice
and make nice.